Chapter 9 of The House Without a Key by Earl de Biggers. This legamous recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 9 At the Reef and Palm. They reached Kalakaua Avenue, and swerving sharply to the right, Captain Hallett stepped on the gas. Since the car was without a top, John Quincy was getting an unrestricted view of this land that lay at his journey's end. As a small boy squirming about on the hard pew in the First Unitarian Church, he had heard much of heaven, and his youthful imagination had pictured it as something like this. A warm, rather languid country, freshly painted in the gaudiest colours available. Creamy white clouds wrapped the tops of the distant mountains, and their slopes were bright with tropical foliage. John Quincy heard near at hand the low monotone of breakers lapping the shore. Occasionally he caught a glimpse of apple-green water and dazzling white stretch of land. Oh, Waikiki! Oh, scene of peace! What was the rest of that poem his Aunt Minerva had quoted in her last letter? The one in which she had announced that she was staying on indefinitely. And looking down from Tum-Tum skies, the angel's smile on Waikiki. Sentimental, but sentiment was one of Hawaii's chief exports. One had only to look at the place to understand and forgive. John Quincy had not delayed for a hat, and the sun was beating down fiercely on his brown head. Charlie Chan glanced at him. "Humbly begging pardon," he remarked. "Would say it is unadvisable to venture forth without headgear, especially since you were Malahini."
"A what?"
"The term carries no offence. Malahini, stranger, newcomer." "Oh!" John Quincy looked at him curiously. "Are you a Malahini?"
"Not in the least," grinned Chan. "I am Kamaina, old-timer, pursuing the truth further. I have 25 years in the islands."
They passed a huge hotel, and presently John Quincy saw Diamond Head standing an impressive guardian at the far end of that lovely curving beach. A little farther along the captain drew up to the curb, and the four men alighted. On the other side of a dilapidated fence was a garden that might have been Eden at its best. Entering past a gate that hung sorrowfully on one hinge, they walked up a dirt path, and in a moment a ramshackle old building came into view. They were approaching it on an angle, and John Quincy saw the greater part of it extended out over the water. The tottering structure was of two stories, with double-decked balconies on both sides and the rear. It had rather an air about it. Once, no doubt, it had been worthy to stand in this setting. Flowering vines clambered over it in a friendly endeavour to hide its imperfections from the world. "Some day," announced Charlie Chan solemnly, "those rafters underneath will disintegrate, and the Reef and Palm Hotel will descend into the sea with the most horrid gurgle." As they drew nearer, it seemed to John Quincy that Chan's prophecy might come true at any moment. They paused at the foot of a crumbling stair that led to the front door. And as they did so, a man emerged hurriedly from the Reef and Palm. His once white clothes were yellowed, his face lined, his eyes tired and disillusioned. But about him, as about the hotel, hung the suggestion of a distinguished past. "Mr. Egan," said Captain Hallett promptly.
"Oh, how are you?"
the man replied, with an accent that recalled to John Quincy's mind his meeting with Captain Arthur Temple Cope.
"We want to talk to you," announced Hallett brusquely. A shadow crossed Egan's face. "I'm frightfully sorry," he said, "but I have a most important engagement, and I'm late as it is. Some other time."
"Now," cut in Hallett. The word shot through the morning like a rocket. He started up the steps.
"Impossible," said Egan. He did not raise his voice. "Nothing on earth could keep me from the dock this morning."
The captain of detectives seized his arm. "Come inside," he ordered. Egan's face flushed.
"Take your hand off me, damn you! By what right—"
"You watch your step, Egan," advised Hallett angrily. "You know why I'm here."
"I do not."
Hallett stared into the man's face. "Dan Winterslip was murdered last night," he said.
Jim Egan removed his hat and looked helplessly out towards Kalakaua Avenue. "So I read in the morning paper," he replied. "What has his death to do with me?"
"You were the last person to see him alive," Hallett answered. "Now quit bluffing and come inside."
Egan cast one final baffled glance at the street, where a trolley bound for the city 3 miles away was rattling swiftly by. Then he bowed his head and led the way into the hotel. They entered a huge, poorly furnished public room, deserted save for a woman tourist writing postcards at a table and a shabby Japanese clerk lolling behind the desk. "This way," Egan said, and they followed him past the desk and into a small private office. Here all was confusion. Dusty piles of magazines and newspapers were everywhere. Battered old ledgers lay upon the floor. On the wall hung a portrait of Queen Victoria. Many pictures cut from the London Illustrated Weeklies were tacked up haphazardly. Jennison spread a newspaper carefully over the window sill and sat down there. Egan cleared chairs for Hallett, Chan and John Quincy, and himself took his place before an ancient roll-top desk.
"If you will be brief, Captain," he suggested, "I might still have time." He glanced at a clock above the desk.
"Forget that," advised Hallett sharply. His manner was considerably different from that he employed in the house of a leading citizen like Dan Winterslip. "Let's get to business." He turned to Chan. "Got your book, Charlie?"
"Preparations are complete," replied Chan, his pencil poised.
Hallett drew his chair closer to the desk. "Now, Egan, you come through and come clean. I know that last night, about 7:30, you called up Dan Winterslip and tried to slide out of an appointment you had made with him. I know that he refused to let you off, and insisted on seeing you at 11. About that time you went to his house. You and he had a rather excited talk. At 1:25, Winterslip was found dead. Murdered, Egan! Now give me your end of it."
Jim Egan ran his fingers through his curly, close-cropped hair, straw-coloured once, but now mostly grey.
"That's all quite true," he said. Do you mind if I smoke?" He took out a silver case and removed a cigarette. His hand trembled slightly as he applied the match.
"I did make an appointment with Winterslip for that night," he continued. "During the course of the day I changed my mind. When I called up to tell him, he insisted on seeing me. He urged me to come at 11, and I went."
"Who let you in?" Hallett asked.
"Winterslip was sitting in the garden when I came. We went inside."
Hallett glanced at the cigarette in Egan's hand. "By the door leading directly into the living room?" he asked.
"No," said Egan. "By the big door at the front of the house. Winterslip took me out on his lanai, and we had a bit of a chat regarding the business that had brought me. About half an hour later I came away. When I left, Winterslip was alive and well. In good spirits, too. Smiling, as a matter of fact."
"By what door did you leave?"
"The front door, the one I had entered by."
"I see."
Hallett looked at him thoughtfully for a moment.
"You went back later, perhaps?"
"I did not," said Egan promptly. "I came directly here and went to bed."
"Who saw you?"
"No one. My clerk goes off duty at 11. The hotel is open, but there is no one in charge. My patronage is not large."
"You came here at 11:30 and went to bed," Hallett said, "but no one saw you. Tell me, were you well acquainted with Dan Winterslip?"
Egan shook his head. "In the 23 years I've been in Honolulu, I had never spoken to him until I called him on the telephone yesterday morning."
"Hmph."
Hallett leaned back in his chair and spoke in a more amiable tone.
"As a younger man, I believe you travelled a lot."
"I drifted about a bit," Egan admitted. "I was just 18 when I left England."
"At your family's suggestion," smiled the captain.
"What's that to you?"
Egan flared.
"Where did you go?"
"Australia. I ranched it for a time, and later I worked in Melbourne."
"What doing?" persisted Hallett.
In a bank."
"A bank, eh? And then—"
"The South Seas. Just wandering about. I was restless."
"Beachcombing, eh?"
Egan flushed. I may have been on my uppers at times, but damn it!"
"Wait a minute," Hallett cut in. "What I want to know is, those years you were drifting about, did you by any chance run into Dan Winterslip?"
I might have."
"What sort of an answer is that? Yes or no?"
"Well, as a matter of fact, I did," Egan admitted. "Just once in Melbourne, but it was a quite unimportant meeting. So important, Winterslip had completely forgotten it."
"But you hadn't. And yesterday morning, after 23 years' silence between you, you called him on the telephone. On rather sudden business."
"I did."
Hallett came closer. "All right, Egan, we've reached the important part of your story. What was that business?" A tense silence fell in the little office as they waited Egan's answer. The Englishman looked Hallett calmly in the eyes.
"I can't tell you that," he said.
Hallett's face reddened. "Oh, yes, you can. And you're going to."
"Never," answered Egan, without raising his voice.
The captain glared at him. "You don't seem to realize your position."
"I realize it perfectly."
"If you and I were alone..."
"I won't tell you under any circumstances, Hallett."
"Maybe you'll tell the prosecutor."
"Look here," cried Egan warily. "Why must I say it over and over? I'll tell nobody my business with Winterslip. Nobody. Understand?"
He crushed the half-smoked cigarette savagely down onto a tray at his side. John Quincy saw Hallett nod to Chan. He saw Chan's pudgy little hand go out and seize the remnant of cigarette. A happy grin spread over the Oriental's fat face. He handed the stub to his chief.
"Corsican brand," he cried triumphantly.
"Ah, yes," said Hallett. "This is your usual smoke?" A startled look crossed Egan's face.
"No, it's not," he said.
"It's a make that's not on sale in the islands, I believe."
"No, I fancy it isn't."
Captain Hallett held out his hand. "Give me your cigarette case, Egan." The Englishman passed it over and Hallett opened it.
"Hm,"
he said. "You've managed to get hold of a few, haven't you?"
"Yes, they were given to me."
"Is that so? Who gave them to you?"
Egan considered.
"I'm afraid I can't tell you that either," he said. Hallett's eyes glittered angrily.
"Let me give you a few facts," he began.
"You called on Dan Winterslip last night. You entered and left by the front door, and you didn't go back. Yet just outside the door leading directly into the living room, we found a partly smoked cigarette of this unusual brand. Now will you tell me who gave you these Corsicans?"
"No," said Egan. "I won't."
Hallett slipped the silver cigarette case into his pocket and stood up. "Very well," he remarked. "I've wasted all the time I intend to here. The district court prosecutor will want to talk to you."
"Of course," agreed Egan.
"I'll come and see him. This afternoon."
Hallett glared at him.
"Quit kidding yourself and get your hat."
Egan rose too.
"Look here," he cried. "I don't like your manner. It's true there are certain matters in connection with Winterslip that I can't discuss, and that's unfortunate. But surely you don't think I killed the man. What motive would I have?"
Jennison rose quickly from his seat on the window ledge and stepped forward.
"Hallett," he said, "there's something I ought to tell you. 2 or 3 years ago Dan Winterslip and I were walking along King Street, and we passed Mr. Egan here." Winterslip nodded toward him.
"I'm afraid of that man, Harry," he said. "I waited to hear more, but he didn't go on, and he wasn't the sort of client one would prompt. I'm afraid of that man, Harry. Just that, and nothing further."
"It's enough," remarked Hallett grimly. "Egan, you're going with me."
Egan's eyes flashed.
"Of course," he cried bitterly. "Of course I'm going with you. You're all against me. The whole town is against me. I've been sneered at and belittled for 20 years, because I was poor. An outcast, my daughter humiliated, not good enough to associate with these New England blue bloods,
these thin-lipped Puritans with a touch of sun." At sound of that familiar phrase, John Quincy sat up. "Where? Where? Oh, yes, on the Oakland ferry."
"Never mind that," Hallett was saying. "I'll give you one last chance. Will you tell me what I want to know?"
"I will not," cried Egan.
"All right, then come along."
"Am I under arrest?" said Egan.
"I didn't say that," replied Hallett, suddenly cautious. "The investigation is young yet. You are withholding much-needed information, and I believe that after you have spent a few hours at the station, you'll change your mind and talk. In fact, I'm sure of it. I haven't any warrant, but your position will be a lot more dignified if you come willingly without one."
Egan considered a moment. "I fancy you're right," he said. "I have certain orders to give the servants, if you don't mind."
Hallett nodded. "Make it snappy. Charlie will go with you."
Egan and Chan disappeared. The captain, John Quincy, and Jennison went out and sat down in the public room. 5 minutes passed. 10, 15. Jennison glanced at his watch.
"See here, Hallett," he said. "The man's making a monkey of you."
Hallett reddened and stood up. That instant, Egan and Chan came down the big open stairway at one side of the room. Hallett went up to the Englishman.
"Say, Egan, what are you doing? Playing for time?"
Egan smiled.
"That's precisely what I'm doing," he replied.
"My daughter's coming in this morning on the Matsonia. The boat ought to be at the dock now. She's been at school on the mainland, and I haven't seen her in 9 months."
"You've done me out of the pleasure of meeting her but in a few minutes."
"Nothing doing," cried Hallett. "Now get your hat. I'm Pow."
Egan hesitated a moment, then suddenly took his battered old straw hat from the desk. The five men walked through the blooming garden toward Hallett's car. As they emerged into the street, a taxi drew up to the curb. Egan ran forward, and the girl John Quincy had last seen at the gateway to San Francisco leaped into the Englishman's arms.
"Dad, where were you?" she cried.
"Curry, darling," he said. "I was so frightfully sorry. I meant to be at the dock, but I was detained. How are you, my dear?"
"I'm fine, Dad, but where are you going?"
She looked at Hallett. John Quincy remained discreetly in the background.
I've been a little busy in the city, my dear," Egan said. "I'll be home presently, I fancy. If I shouldn't be, I leave you in charge."
"Why, Dad, don't worry," he added pleadingly. "That's all I can say now, Carrie."
"Don't worry, my dear." He turned to Hallett. "Shall we go, Captain?"
The two policemen, Jennison and Egan, entered his car. John Quincy stepped forward. The girl's big, perplexed eyes met his.
"You?" she cried.
"Coming, Mr. Winterslip?" inquired Hallett.
John Quincy smiled at the girl.
"You were quite right," he said. "I haven't needed that hat."
She looked up at him. "But you're not wearing any at all. That's hardly wise."
"Mr. Winterslip!" barked Hallett.
John Quincy turned. "Oh, pardon me, Captain," he said. "I forgot to mention it, but I'm leaving you here. Goodbye."
Hallett grunted and started his car. While the girl paid for the taxi out of a tiny purse, John Quincy picked up her suitcase.
"This time," he said, "I insist on carrying it."
They stepped through the gateway into the garden that might have been Eden on one of its better days.
"You didn't tell me we might meet in Honolulu," the boy remarked.
"I wasn't sure we would." She glanced at the shabby old hotel.
"You see, I'm not exactly a social favorite out here."
John Quincy could think of no reply, and they mounted the crumbling steps. The public room was quite deserted.
"And why have we met?" the girl continued.
"I'm fearfully puzzled. What was Dad's business with those men? One of them was Captain Hallett, a policeman."
John Quincy frowned.
"I'm not so sure your father wants you to know."
"But I've got to know. That's obvious. Please tell me."
John Quincy relinquished the suitcase and brought forward a chair. The girl sat down.
"It's this way," he began. "My cousin Dan was murdered in the night." Her eyes were tragic.
"Oh, poor Barbara!" she cried.
"That's right. He mustn't forget Barbara. But, Dad,
oh, go on, please.
Your father visited Cousin Dan last night at 11, and he refuses to say why. There are other things he refuses to tell." She looked up at him, her eyes filled with sudden tears.
"I was so happy on the boat," she said. "I knew it couldn't last."
He sat down. "Nonsense. Everything will come out all right. Your father is probably shielding someone." She nodded. "Of course. But if he's made up his mind not to talk, he just simply won't talk. He's odd that way. They may keep him down there, and I shall be all alone."
"Not quite alone," John Quincy told her.
"No, no," she said. "I've warned you. We're not the sort the best people care to know."
"The more fools they,"
cut in the boy. "I'm John Quincy Winterslip of Boston, and you—"
"Carlotta Maria Egan,"
she answered. "You see, my mother was half Portuguese. The other half was Scottish-Irish. My father's English. This is the melting pot out here, you know." She was silent for a moment. "My mother was very beautiful," she added wistfully.
"So they tell me. I never knew."
John Quincy was touched.
"I thought how beautiful she must have been," he said gently, "the day that I met you on the ferry."
The girl dabbed at her eyes with an absurd little handkerchief and stood up. "Well," she remarked, "this is just another thing that has to be faced. Another call for courage. I must meet it." She smiled. "The lady manager of the Reef and Palm. Can I show you a room?"
"I say, it'll be a rather stiff job, won't it?"
John Quincy rose too.
"Oh, I shan't mind. I've helped Dad before. Only one thing troubles me. Bills and all that. I've no head for arithmetic."
"That's all right. I have," replied John Quincy. He stopped. Wasn't he getting in a little deep?
"How wonderful," the girl said.
"Why, not at all," John Quincy protested. "It's my line at home."
Home? Yes, he had a home, he recalled. "Bonds and interests and all that sort of thing. I'll drop in later in the day to see how you're getting on."
He moved away in a mild panic. "I'd better be going now," he added.
"Of course."
She followed him to the door.
"You're altogether too kind. Shall you be in Honolulu long?"
"That depends," John Quincy said. "I've made up my mind to one thing. I shan't stir from here until this mystery about Cousin Dan is solved, and I'm going to do everything in my power to help in solving it."
"I'm sure you're very clever, too," she told him.
He shook his head.
"I wouldn't say that, but I intend to make the effort of my life. I've got a lot of incentives for seeing this affair through."
Something else trembled on his tongue.
"Better not say it. Oh, Lord, he was saying it."
"You're one of them," he added, and clattered down the stairs.
"Do be careful," called the girl. "Those steps are even worse than they were when I left. Just another thing to be repaired. Some day, when our ship comes in."
He left her smiling wistfully in the doorway, and hurrying through the garden, stepped out on Kalakaua Avenue. The blazing sun beat down on his defenceless head. Gorgeous trees flaunted scarlet banners among his path. Tall coconut palms swayed above him at the touch of the friendly trades. Not far away, rainbow-tinted waters lapped a snowy beach. A sweet land, all of that. Did he wish that Agatha Parker were there to see it with him? Pursuing the truth further, as Charlie Chan would put it, he did not. End of chapter 9.